have to say that sitting here and looking out there, there are so many more people than I ever noticed before. I mean, it's a whole different perspective. This preparation for this Way-Seeking Mind talk has been pretty interesting in that I've been trying to put together, well, you know, what is it for me? And in the process of doing that, I was married for 16 years to a naval officer, and we moved every 1 year, 2 years, 6 months, whatever. We moved a lot. And a lot of my memories are tied to where I lived at any given point. And I couldn't remember all the places or the timeline. So I called my ex-husband to find out. And the gift in all of that, we had a 2.5-hour conversation that was really an amazing gift that I don't think would have happened otherwise. And then there was one other, a teacher of mine, who introduced me to my first spiritual teacher. And I couldn't remember when or whatever, and I called him and hadn't spoken with him in like 4 years. And had also an amazing conversation with him. So that in itself is an amazing gift. So I have a timeline of where I lived and when to help me figure out, you know, what was going on. I was born in the Bronx. I grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in a neighborhood that was called Hillside, and there were no hills. I never could figure out why they named it Hillside. And it was a neighborhood that was one city block wide and seven city blocks long that comprised Hillside. So there were a lot of people there. And in thinking about that and thinking about how I grew up, I realized, and I don't know if I'm rewriting history or not, but it's how I feel now, that I grew up in this amazing community of people. There were a million mothers because I couldn't get away with anything because somebody would see me, and everybody knew everybody. And I can remember being in a tree one time. I like to climb trees, and I was sitting in a tree, and out of nowhere, I heard, "Jerry, get out of the tree, I'm going to call your father." So, you know, while I got told on a lot, I felt very protected and very happy to be in this community in which I felt so safe. My family was Jewish, culturally Jewish, but not religiously so. And the neighborhood I grew up in was, you know, part Jewish, part Christian, you know, people of a lot of different faiths. And so I was not brought up with faith. I was not brought up with spirit. I was not brought up with religion. But I was curious about it. And so at some point I went to Hebrew school. And was amazed to have this teacher who had blonde hair. I'd never seen blonde hair before. Very, very blonde hair. And I had a major, you know, kid crush on her. And I didn't feel like I was learning anything about spirit. We were learning Hebrew, which was learning letters and sounds. But I loved my teacher, so I was going to stay with it. And came Hanukkah time, the first, you know, so I was in the class for 3 months. And I got elected to go buy her Hanukkah gift that everybody pitched in for. And I bought her something that I thought was the most amazing gift. And I gave it to her and I got kicked out of Hebrew school for it. It was a set of underpants that had the days of the week on it, which I thought... which I thought was the most amazing thing. And she felt very dishonored by that, and I didn't quite get it. But anyway, so I was at the Hebrew school, that ended it. Also about this time, I quit eating anything that my mother would cook, And so our neighbors were Italian Catholic, and so I had dinner over there every night for about almost a year. It was the kind of community that we had. If one parent didn't work, they sent you to somebody else, like the neighbors. And they were Catholic, and my friend was going through, she went through, you know, confirmation and all the Catholic things. So I went to church with her. And the very first time I walked into the church with her, I was amazed. It was beautiful. It was quiet. It felt like, in retrospect, it felt like spirit was there. And I wanted to go. So I went to church with her a number of times with her family. And it was okay with my family. And then I decided to talk to the priest, and I tried to go to confession. I tried to go to confession. I knew what to say. I went in and I said, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned." And he knew it was me. I knew it was him, because in confession, you can see through, which was kind of a surprise to me, because I had never been there before. And so I talked to him, and then he looked at me and he said, "Jerry, can we step outside the confessional?" And so we stepped out. It was kind of, I guess, for him, it was kind of inappropriate for me to be making confessions about, you know, getting kicked out of Hebrew school and stuff like this. So we stepped outside the confessional. He was very, very kind to me. And, you know, said that I was welcome to be in church. And to come to church services, and I was on a softball team there also, and that I could continue doing that. But without my parents' permission, it was not exactly the right thing for me to be coming to confession. So that kind of ended that journey. That I didn't know where else to go, but I did like going to church. It was something about it. Okay, so here's now. I don't think I would know my own life. So anyway, I just kind of moved on in my life. There was no religion. There was no practice of anything. And, you know, I tried. I just moved on. That was the end of it. I had one other thing that happened that kind of killed it. After I had gotten married, I had moved on. After I had gotten married, I had come home to visit my family. And it was around Christmas time, and I had gotten my old job back. My husband was deployed somewhere, and I wanted to earn some money. So I got my old job back, and I came home after work one day. My dad was kind of sitting there in his bathrobe. My mom said that they were waiting for the doctor. And the doctor came, and about 15 minutes later, he died. He was 46, he had a heart attack, and he died. And so there was my mom. I had two little sisters, and I didn't know what to do. So I called the rabbi, the same rabbi that kind of kicked me out of Hebrew school, but I didn't know what to do. I was 19. This had never happened before. He refused to come. He said that he was busy, or he wasn't feeling well, or whatever it was, but, you know, he refused to come. Fortunately, about 10 minutes later, my aunt and uncle arrived, and they were grown-ups to kind of figure out what to do. And that was kind of like the famous final thing for me in terms of this search, this conscious search for spirit. See, I don't have to talk about any of that. At some point, I think it was, I moved to Monterey. My ex-husband's brother was an assistant to Suzuki Roshi. He was living at either Tassajara or City Center. And when we lived in Monterey, we kind of re-engaged as family. I met Suzuki Roshi. I used to drive down to Tassajara in the summertime when my kids were in camp. Either I would take them if I could, if they weren't in camp, or I would drive down to visit Alan. And one day I drove down and I parked my car, and he was moving rocks. Suzuki Roshi was having him move rocks. Alan was 6'5". He was very strong. And Suzuki Roshi came about up to here on me. He was you know, very short. And I had seen him, but from a distance, and I didn't know that until then. And I was sitting there watching Alan move rocks. And at some point, Suzuki Roshi looked at me, and he smiled at me. And I don't want to sound kind of airy-fairy about this, but it kind of went straight through me. He smiled, and his smile came from the very tips of his toes and up through his head. His eyes sparkled, and he looked at me, and he smiled. And I was absolutely moved, moved beyond words. I sat at lunch with him and Alan and a whole bunch of other people that day at Tassajara, and I was dumbfounded. I just sat there. I couldn't speak, but I kept looking at him. And I went back home, and I would go up to Zen Center. I'd go up to City Center to visit Alan, and I heard about Zazen, and I heard about meditation, but I didn't know what it was, because when I was there, that's not what was going on in those moments in time. And I decided that I wanted to learn to do this. I wanted to be around these people, the people that I met at Tassajara and the people at City Center. And where I lived in Monterey was midway time-wise between Tassajara and City Center. So when Alan and his friends would leave Tassajara at night, they would come to our house, and I'd wake up in the morning, and there'd be anywhere from 3 to 5 monks in my house. So I got to sit and talk to people. It was a man named Tommy Dorsey, David Chadwick. There was a woman, I can't remember her name. She had a shaved head. You might know who she was.
Shaved head, let me think. Who
could that be? Right,
right. She wore robes.
She wore robes too.
Yeah, she had, yeah, it was weird. So they would come out, and I would sit in the morning. I would wake up in the morning, and there would be all this food. They would make food. They would bring, you know, vegetables and bread and whatever from Tassajara. And I would sit, and I would ask questions about what is this thing? What is meditation? What is it that, you know, like that you're doing? And I became absolutely engaged with what was going on. And unfortunately, it came time to move again, so we were moving to Hawaii. But I decided that, okay, I found something that I really wanted to do. I didn't get that sitting Zazen was different than other kinds of meditation. I thought it was all the same thing. You sit there, you close your eyes, you know, you're meditating. But I got to Hawaii and I figured, okay, maybe I could use some instruction. So I went and I did TM, did the whole course of TM. And I wasn't involved with TM, I just went to learn to meditate, and I meditated almost every day on the beach. When I was on the beach, I would walk down to the beach either at sunset or sunrise, and I would meditate. I had no clue really what I was doing though. I mean, I was just meditating and sitting quietly, and it added something really important to my life. So time to move from Hawaii. We went from Hawaii to Washington, D.C. I was in training. I was in graduate school, both in Hawaii and in Washington. I was in training. I found a teacher who was training me in Gestalt therapy, and he was also involved with Siddhi Yoga and Muktananda. So off I went. With him. He had a community. It was like a sangha, but it was called it's not a sangha, it was called something else. And we met every Sunday morning, and we chanted, and we meditated. And what was transformational, I brought this with me because there was something transformational about this. This is it's a prayer card from Muktananda. And he gave it to me when I was introduced to him. The chant was Om Namah Shivaya. And what it means is, this is the great redeeming mantra. It comes from the guru. Repeat it. It means, I bow to Shiva. Shiva is neither Hindu nor Muslim, nor Buddhist nor Christian. He is your own self. He is the self of all. Shiva is inner bliss, boundless love. And there's something about this that absolutely struck me as being really important. And it was the first time in that what I was learning is that honoring myself was the most important thing to do. Because if I honor myself, then I can honor others. And I can be available to others. I never thought about that in all of my training as a therapist. It never occurred to me to do this. So it was pretty amazing to me. And I stayed with Siddhi Yoga until Muktananda died, and then everything changed after that. The practice became very different from what it was. So there I was. I still meditated. I still would chant Om Namah Shivaya, silent meditation. What I loved about Siddhi Yoga, by the way, was the fact that that we would do these 24-hour chants, sometimes 24 hours of just chanting Om Namah Shivaya, and it was blissful. It was absolutely blissful. And so I knew that I wanted to be in a practice. And the very first, for me, the first one that touched me was Zen, was this practice. And even though I didn't understand it, I think that I said, when I went to, I'd been to Tassajara a number of times prior to this trip that we made as a group, but I never really understood what it was until I went back and became part of it. And so I found Ed, and I found this Sangha. And from day one, when I walked in here, I felt like I'd come home. And it was and has been guiding me in so many ways when things get weird, or I can't figure something else, or I get a little anxious. I just sit and I meditate. Different from what I did when I was involved in Siddhi Yoga. I don't say Om Namah Shivaya. I just attempt to meditate in our practice. I wanted to say also, during the time when I had met Suzuki Roshi and I was living in Monterey, I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Be Here Now. Those are the two books that were available. And I would sit and I would discuss them with friends. And Abby, you said last week, I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind and had no clue about what I was reading. And there would be these momentary parts where I would say, ah, okay, I get it. And then it would be gone. But Be Here Now was a little more understandable. And it helped me kind of continue a path that I wanted to, you know, like to be on. God, I feel like I've jumped all over the place. I can't imagine ever leaving this practice. It's been very, very important to me. And interestingly, when I spoke with my ex-husband he said, well, why are you doing this? Why do you need to know this information? And I told him what I was doing. And what I expected from him was, oh my God, another one of your crazy things that you got into. And especially because his relationship with Alan was so difficult. And he pretty much dismissed most everything that Alan did. I don't know that he ever tried to understand it, but he was very supportive and very kind about it and very interested in it, which was also a gift. When I called him, I said, well, I'm just not going to tell him what I'm doing because he'll be very critical, which is what he generally was. And he wasn't. So that was such a gift from him. And then reconnecting with Rudy, who is my teacher, who is always a little bit kind of out there. And when, as soon as he heard that it was me on the phone, he said, okay, let's close our eyes and let's connect by our heart and let's meditate together. So we did it on the phone. It was lovely and wonderful. And he was also very supportive of this practice. I don't know, I think I spoke very fast. I know if there's... So I guess that's the short version of how I got from there to here. I wish, you know, in retrospect, I wish that I feel sad when I think about that rabbi. Not mad, but I feel sad because I really wanted to know. But I didn't know how to ask. I didn't know what to do. So, but I'm grateful because it was a step that, you know, that led me here. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Jay, how old were you when that happened with Rabbi?
The first time? You mean when I was a kid?
Yeah, when you were
I was 11.
And the whole underwear incident, you were 11?
I was 11. Yeah.
That just makes me so sad. Mm-hmm. So sad.
Yeah.
What a kind, generous thing you did, and who would do something like that to somebody who's a kid, mm-hmm. who's giving a gift? I think it's really disappointing.
Yeah.
But thank you for your talk. It was really inspiring.
It was
interesting how you met Suzuki Roshi after you've been there so long ago.
Yeah, it was so long ago, and I would meet him periodically. I would end up at a meal with him when I visit Allen and City Center. Only in retrospect, I was reminded by David Chadwick that I was sitting at the table, and it was Allen, it was Richard Baker, I mean, Suzuki Roshi, Richard Baker, Ram Dass. I mean, not that it made a difference back then, because I sat very quietly. I felt like, okay, I don't really, I just should be quiet. But it was very special, and the meetings with Suzuki Roshi, especially that day when he smiled at me. I mean, he looked at me in a way that I had never been looked at before, that I had never been seen in that way. I never spoke to him, never said a word to him. But it was wonderful being able to see him. And when I used to go to City Center, it was like the same thing as when I said going to the Catholic Church with my friends. There was something holy about it. And coming into City Center, the first time in a long time, I felt like I had walked into a holy place again. And not just the meditation hall, the whole of it. You know, like just the whole of it. It makes me want to whisper. So I'm very grateful to Alan, who was so generous in terms of including me in so many things. He would invite me to come to City Center, and I would go to his room. And I remember walking to his room one time, and he had a stereo, a color TV, and a phone. And recently, I found a letter from him that he had written right after Suzuki Roshi died. That he had sent, and I found it, and he talked about his sadness in it, and then he talked about how he was going to be more serious about his practice and give up his color TV, and he'd already gotten rid of the phone. So,
your brother or your brother-in-law?
My brother-in-law. It's my ex-husband's brother. They were about as different as two people could be, and Alan was... He was wonderful, and I loved him a lot, and he was a lot crazy.
What happened to him?
He died, I think, I think he died about 10 years ago. And when I talked to my ex, he said, well, he died alone. And I said, what? I didn't know, and I felt so badly. He was in Colorado when he died. And then David Chadwick, who was the keeper of all things Zen, said that wasn't true, that he died in Cobenchino's arms. And he told me what Alan's last words were, and that he died at peace. You know, and I spoke to him about a week before he died. I had been able to get through to him, and then he shut off all phone calls and wasn't taking any more phone calls. So, but as he was somebody who was important to me, he would lead me into places that I'd never been and had never... He would lead me into places that I never would have been without him. I never would have gone, I never would have tried. And I'm very, very grateful. I'm very grateful to him. I'm grateful for his willingness to include me in so much. And I'm sorry he's not here now, because he kept telling me that I needed to do more of this. But I hope he knows. Yeah, hi.
Thank you so much. I see that your Buddha nature, you've always brought so much inclusiveness everywhere you go, and your curiosity. It's almost like I don't even want to ask this question, but I'm curious, because I think it's just innate in you. But your past and your spiritual path, how did it support this inclusive quality that you have in such abundance? Was it? I hear what you say about Alan, and somehow you recognize, like when you saw Suzuki Roshi's smile. Do you think that you were just always such an inclusive person, or were you supported so much along the way?
Well, I was supported in ways that are not spiritual. I had, growing up in the community that I grew up in, it was an amazing community of people who really looked after each other and took care of each other in ways, in things like, I can remember one time I was walking home from school and I walked by the bakery, and I can't remember her name, the woman that worked in the bakery, you know, called me in, and she said, Jerry, so-and-so left her stuff here, will you take it to her? And it was just part of how we lived growing up in a very supportive way.
So community is actually a very spiritual part of your life, if we look at it.
Yeah. And then, you know, the community in which I grew up, which was all of these mothers yelling at me for all kinds of things, you know, things that they thought I shouldn't be doing, like hanging upside down in a tree or walking on the roof, on the edge of the roof of a building or something. It was just being part of this, and there was never any, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. It wasn't like that. It was just a community of support, of giving. I think I was really lucky. And that was one other phone call that I made, because I didn't know if I was rewriting history about this. And I called my best friend that we went to nursery school all the way through college together, and we're still very, very good friends. And we grew up next door to each other. I called her, I said, am I confabulating this? You know, this is how I'm remembering this. And, you know, she remembers it in the same way. So I think that's more in the nature of what I was, how I learned by others, by how others were. It was really wonderful. Thanks, Kim.
Carrie, I remember how anxious you were about making Way-Seeking Mind talk.
I still am.
It's just so wonderful to hear your story and to hear you go right to those points of suffering, really, that were, as well as joy, that were so important in your life. What you haven't mentioned is something that's implicit in some of the stories that you told, which is the feeling of loneliness in the midst of that neighborhood where everybody knew everybody's business. Yet, I know from what you've talked about that you were lonely. There was a sense of exclusion as well as inclusion, and I guess that makes your loving nature, your open and trusting and loving nature, so much more impressive to me. But that sense of wanting to connect and of kind of being kicked out in numerous situations, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think a lot of that was, for me, when you say that, what comes up is when I was 12, my mom went back to work, as did most of the moms in the neighborhood. It wasn't unusual. And so from the time that I was maybe 12 or 13, I was responsible for my two younger sisters. So I would have to come home from school, make sure that they got home, have dinner on the table when my parents came in. So it was, you know, it was hard when I wanted to kind of be out, you know, with my friends, but it just wasn't the way that it could be. But the beautiful part of that is talking to my friend from a long time. She and my friends used to show up and give my kids, my sisters, piggyback rides, and help me in taking care of them, because there's a lot of responsibility to come home from school and you know. Sometimes I had to shop for food. But the thing is, you never shopped with money in my neighborhood. My mother would say, get lamb chops. I'd go to the butcher and I would say, my mom wants lamb chops. And he would say, you'll take chicken, the lamb's not so good today. But no money, no amount, you know, no, I didn't have to tell him how many pounds or anything. He knew our family and he knew. So it was kind of a combination of it. It was, you know, it was hard. You know, I was a kid, man. I wanted to be out climbing trees and running and doing all these things. And, you know, it just, our family didn't work that way then. You know, my dad was a cab driver, and he used to work from 3 in the afternoon and come home, you know, very late at night, and he frequently would come home for dinner also. So he'd come home for dinner and then he would go back out to work. But it never felt like a huge hardship. You know, like I wished that I could be doing other things, but it didn't feel like this huge hardship. Although my sisters might tell you something different.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was curious how your spirituality impacted on your profession, what you do.
It's been profound. I mean, it's not that I talk about it, you know, with people, but it certainly helps me stay connected to them, I think, in a very important way, and here on a different level. So I'm not just hearing their story, I'm hearing what's underneath. And, you know, like one time I was seeing somebody and I had this idea that, you know, like maybe meditating would be good for this person. And yeah, don't intrude on that level. But I think it's very much part of what I do.
Well, I think people in your profession have to absorb more than most people. Mm-hmm. If I'm not, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a very particular thing that you do. It's not like going to the office and doing some typing. It's actually a very human thing. And that's why I asked you that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I absorb anything any more than anybody else, but I don't know. It's an interesting question. I'll have to think about it. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your talk, Jerry. I loved listening. I found that, like you, I was really very saddened and angry at your being kicked out, but also when your father died. Mm-hmm. I was very moved, just as a human being, mm-hmm. that somebody would say they were too busy to help you. It had nothing to do with it being... I mean, a rabbi brought him up another level because he really could have told you what to do.
Or he
and he didn't.
Yeah, and I feel really sad. What's interesting, however, my aunt was dying, and I had this need to call a rabbi. Not that rabbi. And I called this rabbi in Carmel Valley. I didn't know anything about him, but she was dying in a hospice in Carmel Valley. And he was the most amazing human being. He was so present. He was so there. He was so supportive and so loving. So he kind of erased, you know, like that old guy.
But I just think about your being 19 years old and having that happen, how traumatic. Mm-hmm. How traumatic that is, because you're really, really reaching out. Mm-hmm. And it's not there.
I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to, my mom was, you know, desperately broken up. My sisters were little. And the way they found out that my father died was awful, because the paramedics came. And I had sent my sisters downstairs to guide them up to the apartment. And I guess one of the paramedics hung out the window and went like this. And that's how my sisters found out. That he had died.
So insensitive.
It was
so insensitive.
It was like, you know. But, you know, but. But community arrived.
Well,
the community arrived.
And I know you a long time, and I never knew your story. And so I'm very touched by it.
Thank you.
Well spoke. It's lovely, Jerry, to see these pictures. I love the picture of your childhood with the, everybody knowing everybody and not having to pay for food right then. The whole business, that's a story unlike anything out here in California.
Yeah, I mean, well, I didn't realize until I was thinking about this. I didn't realize how incredible that was, especially in our times.
A sort of old world kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
When you bring that community with you, you really do. I mean, I've been in and out lately, but you're just so inclusive to me about, you know, welcome. And so and the different parts of your story are just so fascinating. You know, I mean, going the experience with the rabbi, and then the Catholic Church, and yet you still keep going, and then you ended up here, and we're lucky.
Thank you. Yes, so am I. It's been great.
And I think following that, I have two questions. I think one is, you seem to be a part of, or had this kind of Zen practice for a long time, with your brother-in-law being Tassajara and all that, and then here. What was it that you didn't participate back then? You just kind of listened. And now, what was different now that you participated?
I didn't know how. I absolutely didn't know how. I didn't know what to do. When I moved to Hawaii after meeting Suzuki Roshi and knowing all these people from Zen Center, I really wanted to do that. But I really didn't know what the difference between Zazen and any other kind of meditation was. And when I got to Hawaii, I looked for a Zen place, but apparently it was on Maui at that time. Mm-hmm. And there may have been some places in locally, and I think Al, you had said that there was some place in Kaimuki, maybe at that time?
Manoa.
Manoa?
Yeah.
But I didn't know how to find it. So I, you know, there wasn't, you know, like, there wasn't a Google thing. So I had heard about TM, and I figured I would, you know, I would go do that. But I didn't stay with it. I just did it more on my own because there was something about that was uncomfortable to me. But I continued to meditate anyway.
And then the second question, why did you stop eating your mother's cooking?
I don't know. I was a little kid and I just quit eating. I didn't like anything that she made. I don't know, maybe it was a ploy to go eat at the Tamaras, you know? I mean, she was an Italian cook, and I went every single day except Friday, because Friday they had fish. And so I didn't go on Friday. But I went every single day and got included in their family. Well, we were, you know. My friend Jeannie was the youngest of all the kids. I was the oldest in my house. It was very different being the youngest, and I kind of liked it. Being included as the youngest, that was good. But that's why, I don't know why I stopped. But it's a family story, of course. And how incredible that I had neighbors that would just include me in their family. I mean, wow. How does that happen today? I don't know. But I was lucky. Thanks, Truths.
Thank you very much. So much of what you said was really fascinating, and purely selfish note, it was kind of like going down memory lane a lot for me. I didn't know Alan very well, but I knew him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's just wonderful hearing your reminiscences. Mm-hmm. And just the other day, I rented a movie documentary, Berkeley in the 60s, and this reporter was interviewing Allen Ginsberg after some big demonstration and asking him, you know, what was his analysis of what was going on, and he took out his finger symbols and said, Om Namah Shivaya, and the reporter kept asking him to expand on that. It's like the Zen story with attention, attention, attention. With every question the reporter asked, he just kept chanting the very same chant.
Yeah. I know that you had said when I first met you that you knew the moving rock story, or you had known that or something about Alan moving rocks for Suzuki Roshi.
Well, there's a story that, I don't know, Ed may have even been there, I don't know how apocryphal it is, but the way I heard the story, Alan and Suzuki Roshi were trying to move some great big boulder, and Suzuki Roshi said they should take a break and go have lunch. Mm-hmm. And Alan went and had lunch. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, the rock was in place. Mm-hmm. And Suzuki Roshi, who was, he said, was, you know, tiny, mm-hmm. had somehow moved it himself and had collapsed.
I recently read that. I recently read about that. And they said they found him in his room and he had thrown up and he was just kind of lying there after having moved this giant boulder.
Is that about how you remember it, or?
I wasn't there for that event, so I've heard the story before, and it sounds good. I, of course, also was very moved by the times in Tassara that you were describing, and in particular, that when Suzuki Roshi turned to you and smiled, I mean, of course, I remember the way that Suzuki Roshi could completely be present, and that his whole body could touch you. Mm-hmm. And to be touched or met in that way was, I think, what you were looking for all along.
Yeah.
And that being touched to stay with you until you found the practice that would give you that same way. And so I just thought it was an interesting thing that something like that stayed so long with you until you finally could find a way to practice it.
It's still very alive in me. I mean, the feeling of when he smiled at me, And the feeling inside my body when he did that and looking at him is like it's happening right now. It was kind of amazing, I think. And I feel like I was really blessed to be there at that moment in time. It was really special.
One of the things that struck me was your durability, your ability to stay open through those very striking, powerful events that could easily have closed you off. And, I was kind of thinking about the Boll Weevil song, which is part of the Black history, the durability, the kind of strength, quiet strength, that allows you to stay open past all kinds of difficulties. It's an extraordinary quality.
Thanks, Kim. I feel really blessed that I found this place at this time, and I found Ed as my teacher, and all of you people. I mean, wow, it's just, it's like a miracle, kind of, you know. All those years of kind of being on this path and finally landing. So thank you, everybody.